I've just bought a whole load of stock at auction. Sarinda nodded. I don't know why. I thought it was just going to be some kind of freezing no-man's land. I thought I'd kind of come and visit you and laugh at men in skirts and ask what haggis was and sing some Proclaimers songs.
The Proclaimers are great, said Nina.
Oh, my God, you have gone so native, said Sarinda. It's ridiculous.
They are great, though.
It was clear that Sarinda hadn't finished.
But it's not like that at all, she said slowly, as a police helicopter lit up the night and filled the air with noise.
It's special up there. A kind of place of the heart. I mean, it just gets to you. Those long fields and the sun that never goes down and the way people look out for each other.
Well, we have to, pointed out Nina. There isn't an accident and emergency for 60 miles.
It just feels like you can breathe up there. Like these silly day-to-day problems and worries don't matter so much anymore. That there's actually time to think about your life and what you want to do, instead of just racing from work to bar to dates to the gym to stupid stuff.
Also, all the hot men, smiled Nina.
That too, said Sarinda, smiling. If you like freckles, which I do.
Come back with me. There's plenty of space.
Sarinda shook her head emphatically as they went in the gate of the little terraced house. Someone had left a bag of poo neatly tied up on top of the low wall. They both looked at it and sighed.
Speaking of which, have you made a date with your dark-eyed stranger?
Nina shrugged anxiously.
I've left him a note. Hopefully I'll see him tomorrow night.
She pulled out her phone. I'm waiting for him to contact me the modern way. Sarinda grinned.
Ha! Look at you. You can't deal with stuff that's not on parchment.
It's not like that, said Nina. But in actual fact, it had been difficult for her to give up their secret message place, the thrill and romance of the tree.
Plus, he hasn't texted me.
Maybe he has, and you're too medieval to work your phone anymore. Nina stuck out her tongue.
Just come back and live with me.
I can't, said Sarinda. I'm too cowardly. I couldn't leave my job, couldn't leave my mortgage and everything. Plus, what would I do? Being an admin genius isn't enough, you know.
I'm sure you'd find something.
But what if I didn't, and I'd be stuck making no money at a job I hated? I hate my job now, but the money's good.
What do you make?
Nina winced.
Yeah, it's not a lot.
No, said Sarinda. You'll never be able to buy a property or take a holiday or get a new car.
I've got the van.
Yeah, whatever. But you love it. You're good at it. I wouldn't be able to do that. Sarinda stared at the tiny, scrubby square of garden, the fumes roaring down the road.
Cup of tea.
Nina had begged for their help, and once more her faithful friends had sweetly heeded her call. Griffin turned up the next morning, looking incredibly hungover and a little ashamed, and, as both girls noticed, wearing the same T-shirt he'd had on the night before. He had, it turned out, ended up pulling one of the young girls who had been out with the gang, and was half embarrassed, half unbelievably proud of himself. Nina was half disapproving, half pleased that he seemed to have perked up a little bit.
"I don't know how to get in touch with her now, though," he said, pretending to look shamefaced as Nina ordered coffee and slap-up breakfasts for everyone.
"I mean, is it Tinder? Is it texting? What is it?" Nina reflected that she still hadn't had a message from Marek. Maybe he'd changed his mind, forgotten all about her, figured they'd taken it far enough. She tried to stop her itchy fingers picking up her phone every 2 seconds.
"Send her an Instagram of a cup of coffee," suggested Sarinda. "Even she ought to be able to interpret that."
Griffin looked pleased.
"I will."
The auction house was an old, dank place underneath the arches of an abandoned railway station. The large man in charge grunted briefly and nodded when Nina showed him her paperwork. Inside were great piles of books from a house contents sale. There were boxes upon boxes. Nina would have liked to have settled down and gone through them all there and then, but there simply wasn't enough time. She had to get back to work. But after Griffin had mentioned it, she'd perused the list fairly thoroughly online before she made her commission bid,
and it suited her purposes perfectly. Many estate book buyers were looking for rare first editions, but she wanted good copies of contemporary books to sell on, and this collection didn't disappoint. Loads of recent fiction and non-fiction from a careful, non-spine-bending reader. She'd definitely got lucky. It was another hot, sticky day. The tar was practically melting on the roads. It was strange to go out without her jacket. She hadn't done that for so long, it felt like she was missing something. She got a sense on the back of her neck, something prickling before she saw him. She turned her head as Sarinda and Griffin happily bickered in the gloom of the arches. At first, he was just a dark figure shambling up the road. Gradually, he resolved himself, and she jumped up.
"Marek," she said.
He smiled his slow, lazy puppy dog smile and held out his hands.
"I am here."
"But how did you—"
"Your friend, Sarinda, she say you need help today. She find me."
His voice softened.
"Whenever Nina needs help, I am here."
Nina blinked. She remembered kissing him, how soft his full lips were on hers, how much she had yearned to move closer to his large, bear-like body. She found herself blushing.
"It's so good to see you."
He went to kiss her, but they missed, and he gently kissed her ear, which wasn't ideal, by which time Griffin and Sarinda had emerged into the sunlight, and Sarinda was clapping Marek on the back, and Griffin was saying hello to him in a slightly suspicious way that, had Nina been paying attention, would have helped her to realize that regardless of the young ladies he met in bars, he still had a fairly vested interest in who Nina was seeing.
"How's Jim?"
asked Nina, but Marek just shrugged and smiled, and they started lugging great tea-chests full of novels out to the van, into which Sarinda and Nina had already loaded the last of the books stored at Sarinda's house. Nina was thrilled to see inside them, noticing old volumes of children's stories with thin tissue paper protecting the inside plates, and hand-tooled gold leaf on the covers, along with all the pristine hardbacks. It looked, from the state of things, as if the owner, whoever he or she was, had simply bought everything, without regard to whether they would read it or not. Nina wondered what on earth it would be like to have that much money, to buy that many books without worrying. Every so often she would notice a volume that she wanted to dive into straight away, but she managed to control herself until most of the work was done. Driving back to Scotland with all the books in the back was going to be a true, long-distance lorry driver job, but once she had them up there, she'd be good for months. They drifted afterwards to a little park, and found, with some difficulty, a free spot, clearing away other people's rubbish and cigarette ends so they could sit down and eat ice creams from the van at the entrance that was blaring its radio noisily to attract attention. Men were bare-chested everywhere, and space was at such a premium that Nina could smell their aftershave. The sun beat down uncomfortably on her head, and she wished there was even the tiniest draught. Griffin was lying on his front, exchanging messages on his phone with the new girl, and laughing hysterically, and possibly a bit too loudly, Nina thought. Eventually, he jumped up and said with a mock eye-roll, "Sorry, duty calls, or rather, Judy calls," and the others smiled politely. Then Sarinda looked at Nina and said, "Have you still got your key?" When Nina nodded, she said, "Right, I'm getting out of Gooseberry Land. See you later. Not too much later." Nina kissed her on the cheek and watched as she moved gracefully through the crowds in the park and the great mounds of litter that followed any nice day as the sun started to sink a little in the sky. She felt her heart beat even harder and glanced over at Marek, who had his head down, not looking at her. The back of his neck was pink. Silence fell.
She said finally, feeling she absolutely had to say something. How have you been?"
Marek turned to her, his dark eyes intense.
"Nina," he said, "come walk with me."
Nina stood up. She could tell he was as nervous as she was, but she didn't find this any more reassuring a thought, not really. They walked through the lengthening shadows of the park and out of the gates towards the canal. Slow, narrow boats drifted up and down in the early evening sunshine. People sat outside bars and restaurants, talking loudly. Others were walking dogs or yelling into phones and not looking where they were going. All the normal business of the city on a hot summer's day. But Nina was concentrating on Marek's hand, swinging casually by his side, wondering if she should take it. It felt strange, the two of them together, in daylight, like a normal boy and girl on a date. She snuck a peek at him. He glanced at her, too, and she smiled back. "Through here," he said quietly, and, surprised, she followed him. They stepped off the road and up a side street. Nina suddenly felt a bit nervous, but Marek smiled at her, and she felt reassured. Then she gasped, as the street opened out into the most beautiful little garden square. Nina had never seen it before. In fact, there was absolutely no way you could ever find it unless you knew it was there. It had railings all around it, and a little gate beneath a bower with a small sign, "Craig Hart Community Garden," painted rather charmingly in the handwriting of several different children, decorated with butterflies and flowers. Inside were rows and rows of cabbages and carrots. A grandma and a couple of children were hoeing in tidy lines, the chatter of their voices sounding sweet in the evening air. But apart from that, there were very few people about. Bumblebees buzzed in the air, up and around, and there was the scent of late honeysuckle from a tranche that someone had planted in the flower beds at the side.
"Oh," said Nina, "I didn't even know this was here. It's gorgeous. So beautiful."
"Like you," said Marek simply, drawing her into a secluded corner away from where the family was working. Nina looked into his dark eyes. It was the loveliest evening after all. "Oh, Nina," he said, holding her hand. "Since I came to this country, I came here so far away, and everything is so strange. And I meet you, and you are so kind and sweet and clever, my Nina. And how I love to get your message and send things to you." She found herself moving closer to him. I live in room with many other men. It is so hard. I work all night, and I cannot sleep in the day because I can't find it quiet. And I am sad, and I miss my home so much. And I miss my little boy so, so much. It is hard here, and nobody is friendly, and everything is so expensive. And, Nina, you have done more than you know. You have done so much to make me happy." He pulled her close. Nina froze suddenly. She grabbed her hand away as if it had been bitten. "You have a little boy," she said, thinking immediately back to snotty, bloody Lennox suggesting it as a possibility. "Oh, yes," sighed Marek, clearly unable to read the tone of her voice. "Let me show you photo."
"And he lives with his mother?" she said,
still reaching tentatively for the possibility that he was divorced, separated. That was normal, yes? He pulled out a tatty old wallet. "Here," he said, taking out a photograph. The little boy was Marek's absolute double, big puppy-dog eyes threatening to overspill his long, dark lashes. Beside him sat a beautiful, slender blonde girl, smiling shyly at the camera.
"Who's that?"
Nina could feel her heart thumping in her chest.
"Well, that's my son, Aras," said Marek, obviously close to tears. "And that's Bronya."
Nina squinted at the picture.
"Your wife?"
"No, no, no. My girlfriend. She is Aras's mother. She live with my mother."
Marek's eyes were downcast for an instant.
"So you're still together?"
He looked puzzled.
"What do you mean?"
"You're a couple."
"Yes, but I work here for a year. So far from home. And I am so lonely, Nina. So lonely. And I meet you and suddenly it is like sun coming out. And I have someone to talk to and to write to and to think of."
"But you write home?"
Yes, I call home every day, but what to say? I make money, I am sad, they are sad, my mother and my girlfriend fight. Aras does things and I am not there. He starts to say words and I am not there. I call and everyone is there and everyone is sad and angry with Marek, and I am in my room with all the other men and they say, "Oh, Marek, are you out in bars all the time? You are away all the nights? Oh, Marek, are you having all the fun? Oh, Marek, we are stuck here and we need more money." His voice trailed off. "It is so hard, Nina." Nina swallowed. Her emotions had shifted 180 degrees from anger and bewilderment to enormous pity.
"But didn't you know? Didn't you think that maybe I wouldn't want a man with a girlfriend and a baby? You have a family, Marek. How could I step in the way of that?"
Marek shrugged. "I don't know. It is different here, maybe. Things are different here."
His voice was cracking with hope. Nina shook her head, close to tears.
"No, not that different. I wouldn't... I'm not that kind of..."
"But I did not think that about you," he interjected. "I never thought that about you. You to me were always special, Nina. So special. Not like other girls."
His cheeks were pink now, the wallet still open in his hand. Nina touched his arm gently under the lush green tree.
"Oh, Marek."
He looked at her for a long time, the hope gradually dying in his eyes.
"I am so sorry," he said. "I am sorry. I should not have thought..."
"Oh, no," Nina said, trying not to cry. "Oh, no. You could have thought. You could absolutely have thought."
Marek looked at her.
"When you kissed me on the train, I was so happy."
Nina shook her head.
"I think you need to go home, Marek. Make yourself happy there, at home."
"When I have made more money. When I can look after my family and get a good job and have my qualifications. I have to do what I need to do. That is it, to be good man."
Nina took him in her arms and hugged him, carefully.
"I think you're a very good man," she said, "and I think you're going to be fine."
"I am not good man," said Marek sadly.
"But think about Aras," said Nina. "Think how much he needs you, and needs you to see him."
Marek nodded.
"I know. And soon I will be able to drive trains in Latvia, too, and I can go home."
They had started to walk again, aimlessly, past the old woman playing with her grandchildren, and back out into the sticky, noisy streets.
"But I will miss it," he added. "Not here. Birmingham I do not miss. The men and the room and... no, not that at all. But I will miss Scotland, where it smells like home, rain on the air and wind in the grasses and the stars overhead. I miss it. And I will miss you."
His face was such a picture of misery that Nina wanted to slip her arm through his, but they were approaching where she had parked the van full of books.
"I have to go," she said.
Marek nodded. His face hung, his entire body looked heavy and sad.
"Do you want me still to bring books for you?"
"No," said Nina. "I have to... it helped so much, but it could get you into trouble. You risked so much for me, too much, and I was selfish and wrong not to see it. And I was selfish and wrong not to ask about your family before. I was told I should, but I didn't listen. It's my fault."
Marek shrugged.
"Was not your fault. Was my privilege."
Sarinda was lying on the sofa when Nina got in, tears tumbling down her face.
"I did warn you." I know you did. I built him up in my mind so much."
"Too much reading."
"In my head he was this kind of lost romantic hero."
"He can't get lost, he drives a train."
"You know what I mean, I just wanted, for once, things to happen, things to be nice."
Sarinda sat up.
I am genuinely sorry, you know. I know you liked him. I liked him too. I liked what I thought he was. And he definitely liked you, honestly. People very rarely risk great big gigantic goods trains for no reason if they don't really like you. I think he'd have clung on to anyone who was nice to him. I don't. He's perfectly handsome, you know. He could walk into any bar and come out with women clinging to him like burrs. I think he had a romantic soul, too. I think you were two dreamers. Nina sighed. Well, too late now. He's got a kid and a girlfriend, and all the rest of it going on. Sarinda gave her a huge hug. I'm sorry. I really am. It would have been nice if it could have worked. I know, said Nina. I know. But look at it this way. Someone else fancied you. That makes Griffin and Marek. You're giving off good Nina vibes. Griffin just fancied me because there was nobody else about. Default. And I think Marek thought I was easy and would drop my knickers for him. No, he didn't. Even though you would have. Yeah, well, shut up. Sarinda looked at the clock. Do you really have to leave tonight? Come on, you're your own boss now. I have to go because it'll be light traffic and I have to drive a billion miles. Plus, I need to get back to work and actually earn some money so I can pay for petrol and the occasional bottle of Pinot Grigio. So? Sarinda looked at her. No, there's no point in staying here and throwing a pity party for myself. I'll buy the snacks. Nina shook her head. No, she said again. I don't want to think about it. I want to go home and play the radio loud and never see another train for the rest of my life. She kissed Sarinda and gave her a long hug, telling her to get back up north pronto, and Sarinda hugged her back and said she would be coming up when it stopped being warm in Birmingham because then she could be cold in either place, and told Nina to stop being daft if she ever could. And just look for something real, she whispered. Something real. As Nina drove past the railway station in the noisy Saturday night, she looked at the long trains in the sidings, and despite herself, started to cry. Would it never happen to her? Everyone else got to meet someone, but when she finally did, she ended up with someone else's boyfriend, or just an idea for a person, rather than the person themselves. Look for something real, Sarinda had said. But how could she, when she didn't even know what that was? Chapter 24 Are you ready? Said Leslie, the woman from the local grocer's. She'd been very sniffy about the bookshop to begin with, and disliked Nina's recommendations, as well as expressing general doubt about the entire enterprise. Even though it was becoming obvious that her prophecies of doom weren't being fulfilled, she still liked to come in and poke through the stacks, making disappointed sounds at everything. Nina was determined, somehow, to find something she'd like. So far, historical, romance, comedy, and one of those novelists who specialized in child abduction had failed to hit the spot. True crime had raised a flicker of interest, but nothing had made Leslie rush into going, "Yes! This is the book I've been looking for that will change my life." Very little seemed to make her happy. "Am I ready for what?" said Nina. In the back of the arches at the auction house in Birmingham, where the books had been deposited, there'd been a great roll of brown paper. She'd asked the man there about it, and he'd said it was nothing to do with him, so they had taken it on board too. Now she was becoming expert at wrapping the books up, for gifts or just to take home, tied with the cheap farmer's twine that was plentiful around town. Leslie squinted at her. "Sunday, of course." "Nope," said Nina, "still none the wiser." "How long have you lived in the village?"
10 minutes.
"Well, it's midsummer, you sassenach. It's the midsummer night, the festival." "Everyone keeps going on about this festival.
Are you a heathen or what? Every year, on the longest day, there's a festival, as everybody knows. If we're not rained off, there's dancing and a party and a celebration. And if we are rained off, there's all of those things, but it'll take place in Lennox's barn."
"Well, I'd better come then," said Nina. "I live up there."
"Aye, I know that," sniffed Leslie. "Everyone knows that."
"How's he doing, the poor man?"
Poor man, spluttered Nina. He's, well, he's very rude and a bit obnoxious, if you must know.
Aye, said Leslie.
But he went through such an awful time of it with that Kate. What was she like?
Hoity-toity, said the woman. Posh, not like you.
Well, thanks very much, said Nina. Things around here were never good enough. She complained about the pub and all the old men hanging about outside it all the time.
Nina thought she might have a point about that.
She complained about the town, about how there was nothing to do.
There's loads to do, said Nina. It was true. You could barely walk down the street without being corralled into something or other. There were festivals and choirs and school fairs and shinty matches. It was astonishingly busy for such a small place. Nina had grown to understand the longer she stayed there that because they were so far away from big city attractions, and because the weather was so often not their friend, they had to rely on each other through the long winter evenings and difficult days. It was an actual community, not just a long terrace full of people who happened to live next to one another. There was a difference, and she had simply never realized it before.
"Aye, well," said Leslie, "you probably wouldn't enjoy the party anyway. I don't think there's anything here for me."
Nina unpacked a book she knew well and straightened up. She looked at Leslie, who worked crazy hours, who lived above the shop, seemingly on her own, who always seemed angry about how life had turned out. She wondered.
"Try this," she said gently,
handing over a copy of The Heart-Shattered Glass. The woman looked at the cover suspiciously.
"I don't think so. Just give it a shot and let me know what you think."
Nina lowered her voice in case anyone else heard her. "If you don't like it, no charge." It had become a matter of professional pride now to find something that would suit Leslie. She just seemed to be a woman absolutely in need of the right book. There was, Nina was fervently convinced, one out there for everyone, if only that went for everything in life.
"I hate the longest day," said Ainsley,
who had fallen on the new book boxes with alacrity and was unpacking them with utter reverence, exclaiming over every shiny new hardback, every precious early edition or unbroken spine. It was a marvellous collection. Nina had promised she could borrow some, as long as she treated them well.
"Why? What happens?"
Ainsley sighed.
"Oh, everyone dresses up in stupid clothes and runs about singing and dancing and being idiotic all night," she said. "It's rubbish."
"Seriously? Because that sounds quite nice."
"Well, it isn't. I don't know why people can't just stay inside by themselves if they want to, and listen to their own music, rather than stupid horns and jingly-jangly stuff."
"Horns?"
"Yeah, great big horns. And drummers and stuff. And they light a big fire. It's totally stupid."
"You'd better be coming," said Dr. MacFarlane, the GP, who was standing by practically licking his lips as Ainsley unpacked the big boxes, in case there were any obscure 1920s American gangster novels he hadn't yet read.
"Everyone does."
"Oh, that's a great reason to do things," said Ainsley, rolling her eyes.
Nina noticed from the corner of her eye that Ben had crept in. She was keeping her last copy of Up on the Rooftops by the cash desk, so he could help himself, and she noticed him picking it up, sitting carefully, sounding out the words on the back jacket, moving his lips as he slowly moved his finger. She smiled, and decided not to approach him quite yet.
"What clothes?" she said.
"Oh, you know, the boys in their kilts right enough, but the lassies, they do look braw,"
Dr. MacFarlane replied. Nina had been in Scotland long enough to understand that was a compliment. Since she'd started working for the shop, her plain way of dressing had changed. She'd looked at Ainsley, whose eyeliner today was a startling purple, clashing with her green hair. She looked like Wimbledon. Nina figured it was a good sign she was beginning to express herself and decided not to mention it. She had attempted to talk to Ainsley about her exams again, but the girl had clammed up straight away, and it had not been a success.
"It'll be grand," said Dr. MacFarlane,
surprisingly turning up trumps with a book, the cover of which showed a flapper being held up by a space alien with a ray gun.
"Ach, this'll do.
Wow, I haven't even priced those yet, said Nina. You are fast.
He handed over some cash anyway and said, Look forward to seeing you at the party tonight.
Can I go too?
Ben was whining as Ainsley dragged him away.
No,
she said. Work was easy to deal with, but coming back to the empty barn, with no Sorinda to cheer her up, no midnight strolls to look forward to, no thinking of poetry or little jokes or drawings to scribble down to go in the tree, that really was hard. During the day, she got to see lots and lots of people, but as the endless white night stretched on, and you had to tell yourself to go to bed at 10:30, whether it was daylight outside or not, she felt the hours drag heavy on her hands. She hadn't heard from Marek at all, and hadn't been down to the level crossing to check. She didn't want to know. But she sensed, too, that he himself knew how far they had got, and how close they had been to making a terrible mistake. Or maybe he didn't, she thought with a particularly self-pitying sniff one evening, halfway down a tub of Mackie's ice cream. Perhaps he just thought she was some easy British girl who had turned him down, and now he was on to the next one. Perhaps he never thought of her at all. She sighed. It was even harder with Griffin and Sorinda thinking she was doing so tremendously well up here, that she had it easy. It felt like there was no way back, even if she wanted one, which she didn't. But, oh, she felt so lonely. Sighing, she switched on her very slow internet connection and turned to her Facebook page. Sorinda had made her start one up for the bookshop, which she had thought was a stupid idea, but actually it had been very useful. For starters, it meant that everyone knew where she would be on particular days, so that people could find her. In addition to this, she'd received a message from someone whose name appeared to be Orkney Library. This couldn't be their real name, she decided, suggesting that if she wanted to expand or relocate, their rural visitors would also love a mobile bookshop to complement the lovely independent in Kirkwall. She had looked at the message, smiling. She already felt remote from the rest of the world. Orkney would surely be the ends of the earth. If she ever found the Highlands too dramatic and fast-moving, she thought, and filed it away just in case. There was a knock on the barn door. She looked around, bemused. She didn't get a lot of visitors, except sometimes local children in a complete and utter desperate state of need for the next Harry Potter / Mallory Towers / Narnia, whom she generally managed to oblige, remembering the feeling so well. She opened the door expectantly. To her surprise, it was Leslie from the grocer's. "Hello," she said. "Hi. Can I help you? The van isn't really open just now, but if you need something..." "No," said the woman. "Luke, I just wanted to see... I finished that book you recommended." There were tears streaming down her face. Nina glanced at her watch. Wow, that was fast. The heart-shattered glass was a courageous scream from the abyss from an abandoned woman, written in 4 days from the side of a precipice down which she was hurling all her worldly goods, one at a time, meditating on their meaning. It had taken the world by storm with its candour and wit. The fact that the author had subsequently fallen madly in love with and married the book's publicist had only prolonged its popularity, but it was truly a book that deserved its worldwide fame. It was... She got it exactly, exactly what it feels like. Nina looked at the tightly buttoned-up woman she had struggled to connect with, and marvelled, not for the first time, at the astonishing amount of seething emotion that could exist beneath the most restrained exterior. To look at Leslie, you would think she was just a middle-aged shopkeeper quietly going about her business. The fact that she completely and utterly empathised with an American woman who had let her own blood drip down a mountainside in anguish, who had changed sexuality and howled at the moon with a wolf pack, just went to show. There was a universe inside every human being, every bit as big as the universe outside them. Books were the best way Nina knew, apart from sometimes music, to breach the barrier, to connect the internal universe with the external, the words acting merely as a conduit between the two worlds. She smiled warmly. "That's fantastic. I'm so pleased. Do you want to come in and have a cup of tea?" The woman shook her head. "No, no, I have to get on.
It's just after what I said earlier.
About what?
About you not liking the summer festival. I think I was wrong. I think you have to go.
Nina shook her head. No, I really need a good night's sleep. I find it hard when it's so light all the time.
Leslie looked at her sternly.
Don't be ridiculous. It's once a year. You're a young, single girl. All the single people have to go. It's the rule.
Is it? Said Nina.
Honestly?
She still felt so bruised after the Marek episode, she certainly didn't feel ready to be out and about and interacting with people again.
I'm not sure I'm up to it.
Leslie frowned.
You know, she said, I wasted my youth on that man. We were married at 21, together since school, all the way till I was 50. I never even thought about another man. Oh, Bob was a pig. But I just assumed everyone was like that. I didn't even think about it. I just thought that was the way things were. And guess what? He left anyway. And it was too late for me.
It's not too late for you, protested Nina. Leslie rolled her eyes.
I have wrinkles from the crown of my head to my hairy old toes, and I work all the hours God sends, she said. It was almost the cruelest thing he did, not to leave me when I still had the chance of meeting someone else, when I still had a bit of juice left in me. Me and the woman who wrote that book, we both know we're better than that. But even I don't think I'm going to be crowned Queen of Midsummer in a silly dress. You, on the other hand.
She brought out a plastic-covered clothes bag from behind her.
Here, she said. It should fit you. I was a scrawny little thing, too.
I'm not scrawny, protested Nina. Lennox said if you were one of his lambs, he'd leave you on the hillside, said Leslie.
He said what?
Said Nina, outraged, but Leslie was still shoving the bag in her direction and not listening. Nina looked at the crinkled plastic.
Honestly, I don't think I can.
Leslie frowned.
No, she said. You've come to this town. It's worked out better than I thought it would. I'll admit that. But you're not just here for us to give you money for books. You're in the Highlands now. We have to pull together. It's what we do. You can't just take. You have to give back. There's a lot of people who've worked incredibly hard to make tonight a success, and you owe it to them to go and support them.
I hadn't thought of it like that, said Nina, truthfully. Leslie waggled the bag at her one more time.
Take it. It's going to be the most wonderful evening. Enjoy every second of it. Show everyone that you belong here.
I can't believe I'm being blackmailed into a party, grumbled Nina, but she couldn't help feeling slightly excited nonetheless. After Leslie had left, Nina carefully slipped off the plastic clothes bag and caught her breath. The dress was white, but it didn't look like a wedding dress. It was a very plain chiffon, high-necked, tight-waisted, with a full skirt falling to knee-length. To pin it at the shoulder and the hip was a fine tartan sash in pale greens. What really gave Nina pause, though, was the corset, in deep green velvet, which laced up the front and was clearly meant to go over the top of the dress. It was actually rather beautiful. Nina couldn't think what it reminded her of until she remembered the illustrations of Snow White and Rose Red in her old-fashioned Ladybird books. She smiled and spread the dress on the bed. She wished like anything that Sarinda was there. She'd have found it unutterably hilarious. She looked at her watch. It was 7 p.m. The party started at 8. She bit her lip. Well, if she was going to have to go, and she could tell straight away that now that Leslie had given her the dress, she, and probably her business, would be in huge trouble if she didn't. She was going to have to think about getting ready. Leslie, it turned out, had been absolutely spot on about the size. Nina had a quick shower and washed her hair, letting it fall rather than tying it back as she normally did. It was going to be quite big and bushy, but there wasn't much she could do about that. Then she slipped the white dress over her head. It settled on her hips as though it had been made for her. It was lighter and stretchier than she'd expected, obviously made for dancing. Then she wriggled into the corset. It covered her waist and her ribcage. Her breasts, however, spilled over the top.
She looked at herself in the mirror in some astonishment. She normally preferred shapeless clothes that meant she could be comfortable. This dress, teamed with her flat ballet slippers, was incredibly comfortable, but it was also extremely provocative compared to what she wore every day. She had a sudden panic that nobody else would be dressed like this, that it was some cruel prank to embarrass the new girl. Then she remembered Dr. McFarlane talking about all the lovely girls, and decided it couldn't possibly be that. Could it? Her face flushed pink as she admired herself in the mirror. The corset pulled her waist into nothing, and her bosom, normally small and unimpressive, swelled up and over in a pleasing fashion. No wonder they used to always wear them like that in the old days, thought Nina. She tried an experimental twirl and was smiling at herself when suddenly she became aware of someone standing in the doorway. She whisked round, gasping, horrified, realizing belatedly that it was Lennox. For a split second, he stared straight at her, unabashed. Then he recovered himself. "Sorry, sorry," he said fiercely, putting his hands up and backing away. "The door was open." Nina had left it open after Leslie had left, to let the soft summer breeze in through the sitting room.
"He gave me such a fright."
"I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I'm not that type of landlord. Christ, is that the time?"
Nina smiled. "It's all right. I'm just embarrassed I got caught preening." He looked at her again, but rather nervously, as if he shouldn't.
"So you're going to the festival?"
"No,"
snapped Nina. "This is what I wear when I need to relax." Lennox laughed suddenly, as if despite himself.
"Actually," he said, "I think it rather suits you."
"Don't talk daft."
"I'm not. You look nice. As if you've taken off your cardigan for once."
"I don't wear a cardigan."
"Your metaphorical cardigan. Your librarian's cardigan. It's as if..."
This was a long speech from Lennox, and he seemed to be flailing a little bit.
"It's as if you pull something around yourself, make yourself look smaller and more insignificant than you really are."
Nina blinked.
"Like you don't want anyone to notice you.
In case they want to leave me on a hillside."
Lennox looked puzzled.
"Sorry."
"Never mind."
He immediately turned to go. He got halfway down the path, stopped at the van, then turned round again.
"You can't drive that death trap up there. Want the left?"
"You're going?" said Nina in surprise.
"I am if I want people in this town to buy my wool again," snorted Lennox. "No bloody choice, have I?"
Nina smiled.
"Well then, maybe this time you'll start dancing a bit earlier."
His forehead creased in confusion. He'd obviously forgotten the barn dance completely.
"Wouldn't he have thought so?" he said, heading towards the house. "See you in 20 minutes.
"You have 2 kilts?
Said Nina in astonishment, looking at him 20 minutes later. She had attempted to tame her hair without success, and had ended up simply twisting 2 strands from the front to the back in the style of a coronet. She had given up completely on the tartan sash, not having the faintest idea what to do with it. She noticed now that it was the same tartan as Lennox's kilt, a soft green-grey.
"Have you got 2 pairs of jeans?" growled Lennox.
He had washed his hair, and it fell in soft curls, not hidden as it usually was beneath a flat cap. Likewise, without the waxed jacket on, Nina noticed once again the breadth of the shoulders, his slim but muscular build. He wasn't overworked out. She couldn't imagine him ever working out, as if farmers ever needed artificial exercise. Nor skinny, just nicely proportioned. The grey-green of the tartan made his eyes seem even stronger blue.
"Yes, but..."
Nina decided this line of conversation was pointless.
"Where's your sash?"
I didn't know what to do with it."
"So you didn't even try? Bring it here."
He stood by the Land Rover, and gravely, and with care, pinned the sash to her hip and her shoulder. As he straightened it, they were suddenly standing uncomfortably close to one another, and Nina realized she was holding her breath. She immediately gave herself a stiff telling off, and jumped into the front seat, then out again when she saw that Parsley was already in there.
"Does Parsley dance a lot?"
Lennox shrugged.
"He likes a party. More than I do, at any rate."
"Will I sit in the back?"
"Don't be ridiculous." "On, boy, on."
The dog immediately moved to the back. Nina turned and rubbed Parsley's ears affectionately.
You gorgeous boy, you.
Parsley licked her hand. Lennox glanced over.
You're very soapy about that dog.
Because he's so very lovely.
Lovelier than you deserve, she thought, but didn't say.
Kate always said he was too nice for me, said Lennox, reading her thoughts.
They bounced down the rutted track in silence. There were more cars on the road than usual, partly because normally there weren't any cars on the road at all, and most were heading up the hill towards Corran Moor, full of jolly and excitable people, including, thank goodness, lots of white dresses and girls spilling out of them. Nina looked out of the window, as Lennox seemed typically unwilling to get involved in a conversation. The evening was dreamy and clear, puffs of cloud settling. The sun looked unwilling to shift anywhere.
"How's the train driver?" said Lennox awkwardly, out of the blue.
Nina looked at him in shock.
"Excuse me?"
"I mean, is he coming or what?"
No. No, of course not. No, it didn't—"
Lennox cut his eyes towards her.
"Not quite what you'd thought?"
There was a long silence in the car.
"He had—it turned out he already had a family."
Nina hated having to admit it. To say it out loud.
Not that it's any of your business.
Lennox paused and patted the dog, who'd stuck his head in between the two of them in the front.
Sorry, he said finally. I shouldn't have asked. I did have a bad feeling about him. Something about the way he wouldn't meet my eyes.
Maybe he just thought you were grumpy and scary, said Nina.
Lennox looked surprised.
I'm not like that at all.
Nina harumphed.
Yeah, right. Okay.
I just work hard, that's all. People think there's nothing to keeping a big farm going, but it's a hell of a job.
He caught the look on Nina's face.
What?
Nothing.
What?
Well, who doesn't think farming is an incredibly hard job? But I see Fat Tam out having fun in the pub all the time, and other farmers having a right laugh. Loads of people have tough jobs, but it doesn't make them miserable all the time.
Lennox went quiet for a moment.
No, he said finally. I suppose not. I suppose for the last few years.
He paused again and looked at the bright green hills rolling past the windscreen.
The last few years have been difficult. And it's as if... I don't know if you'll know what I mean, but it's as if somehow... Being low has... It feels like it's become rather a habit.
He looked down at his kilt.
But I'm out now, aren't I?
Nina looked at him playfully.
I don't know. Are you going to hug the bar looking angry all night?
Ah, don't do that.
He did at the barn dance. He spent most of the night talking with that guy and totally ignoring everyone.
Lennox sighed.
Oh, aye, that night...
Oh, aye, that night, mimicked Nina. You know, given all the social events that go on around here, I don't know how anyone keeps up with the whirl of it all.
Lennox narrowed his eyes and kept his focus on the road ahead.
Aye, I remember.
Nina looked at him, waiting for him to elaborate. Eventually he did so.
That was my lawyer, Ranald, he sighed.
He wanted to talk to me face to face.
He tightened his grip on the steering wheel.
Oh, Lord. Sorry, Nina. I didn't want to tell you yet. Not until I knew for sure. I've been trying to sort it, but I don't think I can. I'm sorry to have to tell you this, especially tonight. But I was actually coming over to tell you.
Nina looked at him. His face was pink.
Ah, Kate wants the farm. Or she wants me to sell the farm.
What?
Said Nina. She thought of the expensive lined curtains, the beautiful object so carefully chosen, the care that had been taken over everything. Surely someone with such good taste, with such an eye for the nice things, surely they wouldn't march in and destroy everything. She realized how selfish she was being. This was only where she was renting a space. It was absolutely nothing compared with what was going to happen to Lennox.
Oh, my God, she said. She can't take your farm.
She's trying, said Lennox.
But isn't it a family farm?
Doesn't it really matter, said Lennox. I mean, she was my family. For a while. He fell silent.
But doesn't she have a job?
Lennox shrugged. Doesn't seem to matter.
Didn't she leave you?
That neither.
What will you do if you don't have a farm?
Lennox blinked rapidly. I don't know, he said slowly. Start over, I suppose. Go and work on somebody else's farm. Nina couldn't see Lennox as a labourer somehow.
That can't happen, she said fiercely. I've seen how hard you work on your place.
Well, the lawyers don't seem to think that matters. They bumped slowly up the rutted track, Nina aware that they were even less in the mood for a party than ever. But she had to ask.
Why did you break up?
She asked quietly.
Did she really just fall for someone else? Or was that an excuse?
There was a very long silence in the car. Well, isn't it obvious? Said Lennox.
You're a grumpy old sod, said Nina.
No. That wasn't what I was going to say at all, said Lennox, clearly hurt.
Oh.
There was another long pause. She felt buried away, said Lennox. Felt that I'd promised her something different, something more. No, that's not it. I hadn't offered her anything. She knew what the deal was, and she thought that would be all right, that she'd be able to cope up here in the isolation. But she couldn't. He looked out over the golden hills. The winters are very long here, you know, he said. It's hard. It's very hard to be a farmer's wife. It's not for everybody.
How did you meet?
Said Nina. I was at the agricultural college in Edinburgh. She was at the art school. He smiled. Should have realised, huh? Nina tilted her head.
So why did she agree to come out here, if she wanted to stay in town and be a cool artist?
She thought it would be good for her work. To give herself the solitude she needed to truly become a great painter. Nina thought of the contemplative canvas on the wall.
Oh, she said, that's hers. That picture. It never occurred to me.
She thought again of the dark, gloomy layers, so at odds with the rest of the room. Oh, yes, said Lennox. She didn't want to hang it. I did it. I thought it would cheer her up.
Did it?
Not really. But I did think it was beautiful.
It is, said Nina fervently. It's really beautiful. But why would she want to take your farm away from you, just because she hated it?
I think she's really hard up, said Lennox. It's expensive for artists trying to make it in the city. It's pricey down there. And I think she's been teaching a little bit, which I can't imagine she enjoys that in the slightest. Not really her type of thing. And she says it's for my benefit, that I need to get out of the rut she thinks I'm in, stop working so hard, take on a more relaxing job.
She might have a point about that.
Lennox looked at her. Do you really think that?
I hear you up at all hours, said Nina. I see you striding for miles around the hills.
Lennox's brow creased in confusion. But that's what I do, he said. It's no work. It's a way of life. My way of life. I know she didn't like it, but that's no really my problem. I like it. I couldn't. Man, I just couldn't be in an office all day, doing things on the computer. That'd be torture for me. I'm not an artist like she is, and I'm not clever like you. Finding something the community needs and bringing it in. I can't do that at all. Nina was embarrassed at the compliment.
I think, she said, I think you could do all sorts of things. If there's one thing I've learned, it's that you never know what you can do until you try.
But I love what I do. I love this land. Nina looked at him.
There must be a way. There must be a way to stay.
Lennox shrugged, then extended a hand. They had crested the hill now, and the valley was laid out beneath them, the railway line running through it. Nina averted her eyes from that. Instead, at the top of the next hill was a great crowd of people, striped tents and brightly coloured stalls. There was a steady noise that sounded to Nina like the thrumming of rain on a roof. But as they drew closer,
She realized it was, in fact, the sound of drums. She screwed up her eyes. A group of young men, in kilts but shirtless, with mud spread all over their chests and upper bodies, were banging on huge bowrans and making a massive racket. Every so often, one of them would throw back his head and howl.
"Gosh," said Nina, "is there going to be much of this?"
For the first time, Lennox smiled properly. He had a lovely smile. It crinkled his blue eyes.
"Oh, and the rest," he said.
Then his face fell again.
"Sorry I had to notify you about your potential eviction."
Nina blinked. "It's okay," she said. "I've had an offer elsewhere." Lennox's eyebrows went up.
"Really?" he said carefully.
Nina swallowed. She didn't want to leave Kirinfief. She really didn't. But she didn't see any point in making Lennox feel worse about things than he already did.
"Just sort things out with Kate, however you have to," she said. "Don't worry about me."
The Land Rover came to a halt next to rows of other cars parked in a field. Lennox looked at her and nodded.
"Aye," he said,
but his face was worried.
"I mean it," said Nina.
Lennox got out of the vehicle, then instinctively moved round the back to help her down. Nina had almost forgotten the dress she was wearing. It wasn't quite the thing for scrambling in and out of Land Rovers. He put out his long, rough hand, and she took it.
"Where were you thinking of going?" he said, as she jumped lightly to the ground.
"Oh, Orkney,"
she said breezily.
Lennox stood stock still. "Orkney," he said, pronouncing it the local way. "You're heading up to Orkney. Is this really no isolated enough for you?"
"If I don't have anywhere to live here, I might have to," pointed out Nina.
"Oh," said Lennox. "Aye."
They stood awkwardly. The drumming grew louder and louder, and with it on the breeze came the sound of skirling pipes. Clouds raced across the sky, little puffy things being chased across as if something was after them. Nina heard a crowd of children laughing.
"Are you sure I'm dressed for this?" she said,
and Lennox looked her up and down.
"You'll go," he seemed about to say, then stopped himself.
"Do you know what?" he said finally.
"Ah, I'm in the mood to get drunk. Want to join me?"
"You? What about all the little baby lambs?"
"The little baby lambs are bouncing about eating my thistles. And it's midsummer, which means one is required to get drunk, didn't you know?"
As if on cue, a hugely fat man whom Nina recognized as the local postmaster, even though he was tremendously well disguised, covered in red makeup and with great vines of fruit and flowers draped around his copious shoulders, ran up, brandishing a large horn.
"Bacchus! Bacchus is here!" he shouted broadly. "Worship the god of the midsummer!"
"What is this?" said Nina suspiciously.
"It's midsummer night," said the man. "We make merry and we make magic. Water shall turn into wine, and flowers shall show the way. Also, it's £5.
"That's not answering the question," said Nina, but she took a tentative sip anyway. The concoction tasted a little strange, like wine flavoured with raspberries, but it was fresh and fizzy and good, and she smiled and passed the horn to Lennox, who drank deeply and smiled in response, and handed over £10, whereupon Bacchus shouted,
"Come, come, join the revels. Also, don't forget to support your local post office."
Then, three of the young girls who normally hung around the village bus stop looking discontented with the world and complaining about things, came bouncing up in their white dresses with big garlands of flowers and offered one to Nina.
"I don't think so," said Nina.
"At supporting the local girl guides," said one of the girls,
and Nina rolled her eyes.
"You need to bring deep pockets to the Midsummer Festival," said Lennox. "On you go, then."
And Nina bowed her head and let them put the flowers around her hair. It was, to be fair, the most wonderful party. Little children were running and skidding about, the girls with floral headdresses and their dresses blowing in the wind, flowers everywhere, the boys in kilts just like their fathers, with loose white shirts, and here and there brandishing the little swords that came in their socks. At the gate, where they bought their tickets, was a great bower, bent around with summer peonies and roses, filling the air with their heavy scent. Lennox had to duck to get through it, and beyond it they emerged into the most extraordinary sight. A vast bonfire shot into the air at the very top of the hill, crackling and sending sparks up